para siempre avanzar. He tenido la fe para lograr la victoria.
En el centro de América un pueblo que despertó, porque marcó una senda e hizo una revolución. Ahora lo quieren callar, lo quieren sacrificar, porque a fuerza de balas le quitan su libertad. Una madrugada de gorilas y terror, secuestran al presidente y violan la constitución. Contra el golpe militar, resistencia popular, pues no podrán vencer al gran pueblo de Morazán. Honduras, el pueblo está contigo. Honduras, un pueblo que no calla. Honduras, resiste la batalla, pa' que vuelva aquel que no te falla. Honduras, el pueblo está contigo. Honduras, un pueblo que no calla. Vamos todos a luchar, vamos juntos a pelear, pa' que Venezuela vuelva ya. Honduras, el pueblo está contigo. Honduras, un pueblo que no calla. Honduras, resiste la batalla, pa' que vuelva aquel que no te falla.
Children are always too young to hear the truth, but never too young to be lied to, systematically, conscientiously, in the name of education.
This is Teachers for Class War on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM. Listen online at freakradio.org.
Good evening. You are listening to Teachers for Class War live in studio on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM.
Our guest tonight is Professor Dana Frank from UCSC, who's recently returned from travels in Honduras. And the song we just heard, Honduras, El Pueblo Está Contigo, is a song of the resistance. And so we're going to get an update from a coup-ravaged country and hear about some of the resistance, as well as specifically media-fueled resistance and the discussion of the role of community media in that. In that country. So stay tuned to Teachers for Class War for that and more.
Yeah.
Fuck yeah.
Class conscious.
Class conscious. Class conscious.
It's a class war. Say it loud. It's a class war. It's a class war. It goes on every day. People getting paid in a crazy way. It's a class war. Said it's a class war.
Class war.
Monetary, mental, physical decay. Monetary, mental, physical decay.
monetary, mental, physical decay. Monetary, mental, physical decay.
Class conscious. Class conscious.
Mala Vista.
Class conscious. Hip hop.
All right. As I mentioned, we're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz. Thank you for listening. And Dana Frank, thank you for being on the air with us.
Thanks so much. It's always such a joy to be on the station.
Excellent. If you want to start by just telling us about your recent trip to Honduras, tell us where you went and when you were down there.
Well, not quite so recent anymore, but I was there February, the last week of February and the beginning of March.
That still seems recent.
First time I'd been back since the coup, and I have to say, I've written about this in The Nation. It was really a completely different country, and that week was probably the most amazing week of my entire life. Not only grasping the enormity of the repression and what's happened to this country since the coup on June 28th, 2009, that overthrew democratically elected President Manuel Zelaya. You know, what's amazing about this country is that despite massive, massive military repression and state terror since June 28, there's this enormous transformation of the Honduran people who really have the sense of their own powers. So many people have a whole new identity as part of the resistance, which has united social movements all over the country. And much to their own astonishment, they have amazing sense of their own powers. And we can talk about all of this, but Honduras was not where any of this was supposed to happen. In fact, much to the surprise of the military and the U.S. government, I'm sure, this massive resistance movement that rose up the very day of the coup has been really growing ever since, everyone agrees, is really this amazing transformation of Honduras and its people.
We often assume that we assume good things about our listeners. So, folks out there, don't take this the wrong way. For anyone who may not, it's been a year, and the attention span of people in this country, shall we say, is notoriously short. If you could briefly just review the coup, I was like, a year ago. It's been 11 months.
Yeah, June 28th is the anniversary, and I would encourage people to pay attention.
Absolutely.
To what's going to be happening down there and here on June 28th, the first anniversary of the coup. I'm sorry to say the anniversary of the coup. On June 28th, 2009, the military of Honduras, acting with the head of the Congress, Roberto Micheletti, and with the collusion of the Supreme Court of Honduras, packed President Manuel Zelaya on an airplane in his now famous pajamas and sent him to Costa Rica. And Micheletti declared himself the president of Honduras, and they immediately started a crackdown of the media and of any opposition and of any real democratic process of Honduras ever since. That was protested all over the world. It was really still seen as what we might call a pariah state to this day. The new government was refused. No one would recognize it for the most part in all of the hemisphere and most of Europe. And we can talk about the role of the United States in legitimating the coup. But in the rest of the world, for the most part, this was very much seen clearly as a military coup. And then after this months and months of negotiations and mass resistance in the streets and protests all over the world, the election that was scheduled for the end of November 2009 was held despite massive protests. I think people may remember that there were huge protests against the legitimacy of this election, and most of the candidates of the Liberal Party, the original party of Zelaya, and the candidates of the opposition in the opposition parties refused to participate in the election because there was no possibility of a free and fair election, no civil liberties. People were being tear gassed if they tried to demonstrate, death threats against candidates and so forth. And so in that very much bogus election where maybe 34% of the people voted, the electorate, out of that came a new president, Porfirio Pepe Lobo Sosa, who was inaugurated by the same bogus coup regime at the end of January. So now we have a situation where Brazil, Bolivia, other countries in Latin America are refusing to recognize this very clearly illegitimate continuing coup regime of Lobo Sosa. And the United States, you know, the very morning of the election, before the results were in, was saying, of course, Lobo Sosa is going to be president, and we're going to recognize this. If you don't know what's going on, I would actually say I don't think it's because we have short memories. I think it's because we have a corporate-controlled media that doesn't want to talk about this or wants to lie about it. And I have to say, I'm 54 years old. I thought I had a lot of critical thinking about the media, but the lies and the silences and the right-wing spin on this story has taken my breath away and still does. And so this is, we can talk a lot about the role of alternative media in this, but thank you for having me here so we even have a chance to get it in the news. And I would encourage people to talk to you, local media, national media, about why aren't they covering what's going on there right now.
Well, let's talk about some of the discrepancies. I mean, can we...
Sure.
Without going too much into, like, retelling the entire narrative, what are some of the major points of discrepancy that you see?
Well, I mean, here's an obvious one involving the New York Times. Well, first of all, from the very beginning, much of the U.S. media was just parroting what Hillary Clinton said. Things like both sides are to blame, or we don't really know what's going on here. And that would be repeated for months, for weeks and weeks. There were things that those of us, it didn't take, it was not rocket science to know within that within a few days that that two GLBT people had been killed over the immediate night after the coup, that people were being killed and or having death threats against them in the resistance, that dozens of people were being killed in those first 2 months and still are, I want to underscore, that, what is his name? The lobbyist, that Hillary Clinton's lobbyist was hired by the pro-coup people. Lanny Davis is his name. Was hired. We knew this within 3 days of the coup, that he was hired to promote the coup in Congress and in the White House. And then, and you know, we're pressuring the New York Times and AP to cover these stories for weeks. And suddenly, 6 weeks into the coup, suddenly there's a story by Ginger Thompson in the New York Times. You can look it up. And suddenly we discover that, gee, Lanny Davis is a lobbyist for the coup government. Gee, suddenly it's discovered that all these people had been killed and that there was all this anti-gay violence. And how is it that those of us that knew anything about Honduras or were following the story knew these things for weeks and they're suddenly discovered? And now this isn't because Ginger Thompson didn't know. Ginger Thompson broke the stories for the Baltimore Sun about Battalion 316, the death squads in the 1980s. She knows what's going on down there, and she's not stupid. But her editors are censoring that story. And I have to say, it was just sort of stunning to wake up that morning and see that story. And I'm like, well, on the one hand, it was great they finally ran the story, but just this sort of repeating both sides are, you know, the problem here. Most recently, watch the spin on the killing of journalists. You may have seen the stories about the 7 journalists that have been killed since the inauguration of Lobo Soso. So we're talking in the last 3 months, and 5 of those are people who have been critical of the ongoing coup government, and one is pro-coup. And it's being reported as, gee, there's a lot of common crime or a lot of violence in Honduras, or something generically called political violence, as if both sides were equally violent. When we have documentary, about at least 60 people have been documented by human rights groups who are members of the opposition, who have been very clearly targeted and assassinated. And this story is not being told in the U.S. media, except in the alternative media very rarely. For example, 3 people were killed in the last 2 weeks. Jose Andres Oreda, Gilberto Alexander Nunez Ochoa, and Olayo Hernandez. Those people, they were young people in their 20s, active in the resistance, that were killed in the last week and a half. And you probably didn't see that in the newspaper. And also another thing is to watch the way the protests against the government in Iran were portrayed in the course of the period right after the coup, way in which the street protests there were like the heroic street protests in during the July and August and September period, and the Honduran ones were not covered at all. Mm-hmm. And so why is it that we could see so much visual imagery in that? And then that kind of coverage is still going on and on. Either it's not being covered, or there's this spin now. Clearly the State Department line is there's enormous amount of common crime and this sort of generic political violence or violence by both sides. And I find that so really terrifying and offensive. I mean, we're talking about state terror in which regular people in the resistance, rank and file people, are being targeted for assassinations and also rapes. A lot of other things are going on where people are getting beaten and raped and they're too afraid to report it. And the media is not talking about this at all. And the State Department is very much encouraging this common crime spin. Now, there's an enormous amount of common crime and gang violence in Honduras. And, of course, this kind of crime escalates in the context of a military coup because there's impunity for everybody.
But it doesn't happen without context altogether. There's just the surface level.
How is it that now we want to watch what Lobo's going to do here, because Lobo ran against Zelaya in the 2004 election. Is it 2004? 2006 election. He ran from the right on a law and order crackdown on the gangs campaign. And so now what you can see, one of the things that the government has been doing, this is the current continuing coup regime of Pepe Lobo Sosa, is sort of pointing out lots of so-called common crime as a cover and using that as a cover for repression of the resistance. And there was a very dangerous situation about a month ago in the Aguan Valley, which is on the Caribbean coast, near the Caribbean coast, going toward Nicaragua. And there are peasants there that, this is amazing, this shows you how the resistance has not been cowed and has still been growing. About 3,000 peasants organized in seven cooperatives staged a land invasion of land owned, bogusly owned, I don't know, is that a word, bogusly? illegally claimed to be owned by Miguel Facuse. Miguel Facuse is the big money and brains behind the coup. He's the most elite of these 13 under and oligarchic families behind the coup. And he has planted it in African palms, and these peasant families and co-ops occupied his land in the middle of December. And this is a part of a struggle that was going on long before the coup against this illegal possession by Miguel Facuse. And it's, of course, about demands for land reform. About a month ago, and starting with the Lobo, when Lobo was inaugurated, he started bringing in the troops, both paramilitary and the regular army troops, and in fact was surrounding these folks and starting to kill some of these campesinos or drag them out of bed and arrest them. It was a very, very dangerous situation. A lot of people were afraid there was going to be a massacre, and this kind of escalating paramilitary behavior. And if you watch the timing of it, about a month ago, just as the army is pouring in, suddenly there are reports of a gang massacre shootout in which a dozen people are killed on Saturday night. And suddenly on the Friday, just as the troops are pouring in, as the regular army is pouring into the Aguan Valley to surround the campesino co-ops, suddenly there are stories about escalating common crime and gang activity. You know, not just coincidentally, the so-called gang massacre is the Saturday night. Who knows what really happened there? And all of that was cover for military occupation and potential massacre of campesinos. Now, here's where we come in. People protested this all over the world. We talked about it. We called the State Department. We said, wait a minute, this is really bogus. What's going on here? And we need to protest this, and also very dangerous massacre. There was a negotiated solution, and the army was supposed to pull back. The peasants are supposed to get land. We don't really know who's going to keep their promises on the government side.
So, there's a lot to run with there. First, you mentioned the Honduran military, and again, to provide some context, you mentioned, you know, human rights, the squad in the 80s. This, first of all, your involvement with Honduras isn't new. This wasn't your first trip. And human rights violations and military repression are not new in Honduras. If you could briefly discuss the context there and a little bit of history for folks who aren't aware.
I think some people are aware that the Honduran military, as with other Latin American militaries, has been trained by the United States at what used to be called the School of the Americas, is now the Western Hemispheric Institute for Security Cooperation at Fort Benning, Georgia. So these militaries, leaders at the top of the Honduran military, they're not just some autonomous country out there. They're, in fact, creatures of the U.S. military. They've been trained in counterinsurgency, quote-unquote, tactics against their own people. And we've known that this has been going on for a long time, and people in Santa Cruz have been part of protests at the School of the Americas, which happen every year in November. And we know that the top generals that ran the coup on June 28th in Honduras were trained at the School of Americas, for example, General Romeo Vasquez Velasquez. We know that even after the coup happened, some people went to the School of Americas, so formerly known as School of Americas, and said, are you training Hondurans? And they said, oh, yeah, they're right here. You want to see them? You know, they were right there a week later still being trained in the U.S. We know that the plane that took Zelaya to Costa Rica the morning of the coup stopped at at the Air Force base by Pomerola in Honduras, a U.S. military base. And the U.S. said, oh, yeah, we're not working with them anymore. We're not talking to them on the base. I mean, you tell me whether that's true or not. You know, and now they're back to full military funding and pretending that everything is okay in Honduras when the very same people, military leaders that perpetrated the coup. And here's a really good example. If you think that this is sort of some new democratic regime now, people should know that General Romeo Vasquez is now head of the state-owned telephone company, Hondutel. That makes you feel real safe when you make a private telephone call. And another one of the top five generals is the head of the airport and the immigration service. Just sort of bald evidence of the role of the military in all of this. There was, again, you want to watch out for these kind of illegitimate propaganda type cleanup operations that are going on in Honduras in many ways for the U.S. audience and the U.S. media audience. In January, before Lobo Sosa was inaugurated, they very quickly, within the course of 1 week, charged the top generals with certain crimes against the state for the coup, which they won't call a coup, and then declared them amnesty and that they were innocent, all within the course of a week. So that they then, and then Romeo Vasquez resigns only to be named head of Hondutel, the state-owned telephone company. And you think that's kind of a, well, no big deal. It's important to know the background on this, that the Honduran oligarchs have been itching to privatize the state-owned telephone company for a long time. This is partly why they deposed Zelaya, not just because he was friends with Hugo Chavez or things like that, which are true, but not because he was particularly redistributing the wealth, but because he was also blocking these kinds of mega economic power grabs by the oligarchs.
And that's the question that was posed on by a caller here is why Zelaya? Because it did take a lot of people off guard. You know, radicals on the left weren't picking Zelaya as the next coup.
If you read the
Honduran
left press, which I have for many years now, Zelaya was mostly being criticized. Zelaya himself is from a cattle baron family in Olancha. His father was responsible for a famous massacre of campesinos in Los Horcones. And, you know, he is not exactly a man of the people. He is an oligarch, and he's from the Liberal Party, one of the two families, oligarchic parties, the families that have been running Honduras for 50 years. However, he was from the slightly more progressive wing of one of the two ruling parties. And he, after he was elected, he started drifting somewhat leftward. There were progressive people in his cabinet, He didn't do much, but he also saw the handwriting on the wall of social change in Latin America and how do you address poverty in any way. You have to start talking about redistribution of wealth. Also, where do you get oil? He made a deal with Hugo Chavez with Petrocaribe for oil importation. He established diplomatic ties with Cuba and joined ALBA, the Latin American Alternative Defense Agreement.
But he also signed CAFTA.
Yeah, he did all kinds of things. He did very little to redistribute the wealth, the so-called minimum. He did raise the minimum wage by an enormous amount, but not in the maquiladora sector. Huh. He did start going out and talking to poor people in rural areas, and he was changing. And, you know, but he was also an incredibly erratic and irresponsible figure in a bazillion ways. But it was even that small modicum of shift was too much for the oligarchs because he also blocked a lot of things like the privatization of the ports, the privatization of Hondutel, the massive logging operations, some of the massive logging operations. This is not just coming from Honduras. So the Honduran oligarchs think they should own everything, right? And there should be no social justice at all. So they were threatened by him, one of their own, and felt betrayed by him. And also there's this great boogeyman, Hugo Chavez of Venezuela. Now, whatever we might think of Hugo Chavez, elites all over Latin America, he's their great boogeyman. They don't have the specter of communism anymore.
The New York Times as well. U.S. press outlet, every single article I saw in the weeks following the coup.
It was all about Hugo Chavez.
There were articles that had more to do with Venezuelan politics than Honduran politics.
Yeah, and this is all about Honduras as a proxy war with Venezuela. And this is one of the reasons that the heads of state all over Latin America so closed ranks so completely and so beautifully, and the OAS with the exception of Canada and the United States and eventually Panama, really closed ranks because they know they're next. I mean, this is a test. If they can overthrow Zelaya, well, then they're going to try to get rid of Morales in Bolivia. They're going to try to get rid of the president of El Salvador. They'll try to get rid of Ortega for what he's worth. You know, they'll try to get rid of Correa and Ecuador. And, of course, then there's the dominoes, pushing back the dominoes. And so this is really a proxy war for Venezuela, although it's also about class war in Honduras and the desire of the Honduran elite and the transnationals to have Honduras be nothing but a export platform, a mass poverty export platform.
And that's the I do want to move from the them part. But I also want to get to these business interests. You talked about the 13 families. You mentioned Canada specifically, and I know that there are some Canadian companies with huge resource exploitation going on in Honduras. What are some of the business interests, some of the industries, some of the captains of industry, some of those 13 families? What are the vested interests in the Honduran economy that supported the coup?
Well, yeah, this
and for
is
what reason?
This is what everybody's trying to figure out in Honduras. I mean, there's the maquiladora sector, and much of that is owned. The factories, if not the companies themselves, are owned by the oligarchs of Honduras. Also, there's the domestic banking and telecommunications and transnational banking and telecommunications. There's the two massive banana corporations, Dole and Chiquita, are both there. We don't know what their role is in the coup. I think we need to not overstate their role. Everybody wants to just say this is all Chiquita because
it's happened before.
Yeah, and it's also what I call the Banana Republic school of reporting on the left on Honduras. The only thing people know is that it was stereotyped as a Banana Republic. Therefore, to stop the coup, you boycott Chiquita. Dole is just as dangerous as Chiquita, and they actually, it's not that simple in terms of the political economy of Honduras now, and I think people, part of this has been an education about other sectors. There's a lot of other ag export sectors, shrimp and coffee. Mm-hmm. The maquiladora sector is the most important, and
Fruit of the Loom, Hanes.
And that's Korean and Japanese and U.S. capital invested mm-hmm. there, garment contractors and subcontractors. There are also other there's a fast food industries that are owned, the franchises are owned domestically as well, and the big companies are overseas, and that sector's really been growing. I have to say at this point, we don't really know that much. There are some charts that came out about 2 months into the coup that show what the oligarchs own. We know that they own the television stations. We know that, except one, we know that they own the radio stations, except for the alternative radio stations, what we can talk about. We know that they own all the daily newspapers. Even one paper, El Tiempo, which you can read, is actually a pretty good source. Sort of the middle report, both sides. El Tiempo is owned by Jaime Rosenthal, who himself ran for president. You know, he's no friend of the working people of Honduras, but he represents one particular branch of the oligarchs that actually thought that maybe the truth should be out there in the newspapers, or maybe that the oligarchs had gone too far. So we do know that they have this massive lockdown of the media. But people, I think, are still trying to figure out the political economy of the coup. But it's not rocket science to figure out that the United States government and the transnationals that run the United States government have a stake in this kind of low-wage impoverishment that makes it possible to go there and use it as an export platform and as a market for U.S. subsidized agriculture and to the destruction of domestic production and agriculture.
So to switch gears a bit then for the resistance part. I mean, there's a bunch of we got to figure out who we're dealing with and what's happened and a bit of a review. And so we have a supposedly kind of a conciliatory election, but again, under horribly repressive conditions. There was an immediate response, however, not just diplomatically and internationally, but in terms of street-level resistance to the coup. And the voices that I heard most articulately and loudly were saying, this is not about Zelaya. We're not trying to restore Zelaya, we're trying to restore democracy. It's simply the fact that, you know, we weren't liberals or the left in Honduras. We weren't fans of Zelaya anyway, but you can't have a military coup. It's just about restoring a democratically elected government.
Well, it's really, yeah, I think that the resistance was so massively popular because it really was represented the constitutional rule of law. Mm-hmm. And this massive uprising saying, wait a minute, we are not going to go back to the dark ages of the military coups last in the 1980s. And I think that's one reason it had such a mass base. There are people in there from the Liberal Party that wanted to restore Zelaya. And for most people on the left, even restoring Zelaya symbolized the restoration of constitutional order. Then what happened was, as people poured out into the streets by the hundreds of thousands. I mean, some demonstrations, including on May 1st this year, they're still going on, with 500,000 people in Tegucigalpa and tens of thousands in San Pedro Sula, the industrial city on the north. That all of a sudden people had a sense of, wait a minute, we're finally getting our act together on the left, and that the masses of Honduran people are coming together. And the most important thing about the resistance is that there are many important things. One is that it exists at all and is so powerful, and the second is that it unites all these different sectors. And, you know, we'd like to see this here, right? It unites the labor movement, which including the public sector workers and the teachers, since we're on Teachers Night here. It unites the women's movement, the GLBT movement, which is really astonishing. We're talking about Latin America here. Even in the U.S., to have the GLBT movement so central would be astonishing. And it's not just tokenism. The indigenous people's movements, including the Afro-indigenous people's movement, the Garifuna people, the campesino peasant organizations, which are very strong, and the human rights organizations, and the Zelaya wing of the Liberal Party. This incredible unity and this Frente Nacional de la Resistencia Popular, or the FNRP, and we'll just call it the Frente or the Resistance, came together in this extremely solidified body within a week, and there are precedents for that. And if people are interested in where that came from, I just had an article in NACLA, the North American Congress of Latin America, but just go to NACLA, N-A-C-L-A, and Dana Frank and NACLA, and you can Google it and you can find it. So the resistance, what's really astonished everybody is this this mass organization from below, and it is not—it's not a political party. They've now saying, and I heard it when I was there, but it was actually in the news today, that they are eventually going to become a political party, but they don't want to do that yet because they don't want to get co-opted by the powers that be. And it's also incredibly committed to long violence. I mean, and some of this is because it happened so fast, the coup happened so fast that, you know, it was clear the guns were on the other side. And in classic Gandhian fashion, people have used this nonviolent movement to show the violence of the other side quite successfully. But it's also, most of these leaders, a lot of the leaderships of, and there's different generations in the leadership and all kinds of generations, from babies to old people in the street marches. The babies are not marching, they're being carried. But I know babies. They're babies that I personally have been in these marches, and that have been very committed to nonviolence. And some of this is because of the legacy of the 1980s, when people, you know, these are people that lived through the Central American guerrilla wars and know how many people get killed when you start taking up guns, and really have a vision of something else. And it's also not organized by a Marxist-Leninist party. There are some party like that. There are definitely some parties in there, but very small numbers. That's not who the masses come from and in this movement. And the other most astonishing thing about this movement is that it's in Honduras, which was always seen as sort of the political black hole of Central America. This is not where people thought it would all come together in a mass social movement, and that's part of what's exciting. Let me just say a little bit about some things that are going on now with the resistance. And a lot of this is in a sort of dialectical relationship with what the government was doing. So the government, to make it look like the Lobo Sosa government, to make it look like everything's just hunky-dory, and of course the U.S. loves this stuff. I can say bad words on the radio on this station, but I'm just getting warmed up here. I'll just start with crap, you know, just to get warmed up, okay? And because you never know who's listening to me. Ooh. You know, they have this so-called Truth Commission, which is an invention that's supposed to make it look like we have reconciliation. And this is a totally, what's the word, bastardization of the kinds of truth commissions and reconciliation that happened in South Africa and to a certain extent in Guatemala. So suddenly the right and the U.S. Embassy has discovered that we're going to have democracy and a truth commission. So there's this government-run truth commission that is not going to take testimony from victims, has already given amnesty to all the generals who perpetrated the coup, and has no enforcement power of any kind. So awesome. You know, so suddenly we're going to have this truth commission, but whose truth is going to come out? And this is obviously just a clean-up propaganda operation that you're going to see all over the press and already got. Here's more press lies. So the Frente now has its alternative truth commission, and they've got Rigoberto Menchú on it. They've got another Nobel Prize winner, a very famous literary figure, Helen Umaña from Honduras, Padre Milla, a very famous older Catholic priest from San Pedro Sula area is going to be on it. And so they're sort of saying, okay, you want Truth Commission? We'll give you Truth Commission. They're now circulating a referendum about a constitutional convention. A lot of things have just been happening in the last few weeks. Just in the last week or so, the government has announced that it's going to privatize all primary and secondary education. So the teachers' unions are now having more and more huge demonstrations. They've been demonstrating all year. About a month ago, four judges and magistrates who had opposed the coup were fired by the Lobo Sosa government, and they're part of the Asociación de Jueces por la Democracia, the Association of Judges for Democracy, and now a group of judges and prosecutors of that group are on a hunger strike against that and against impunity.
Judges on a hunger strike.
Yeah, judges on a hunger strike. And they are specifically building on a hunger strike a year ago of prosecutors who were protesting against impunity. And this was part of the coalitions that are behind the resistance now come out of that prosecutors' hunger strike. So it has a very specific history. But when you start having a government, firing judges who opposed it, and then a hunger strike by some of those same judges and other prosecutors, you have a sense of how delegitimated this government is. They're trying to act like they're a legitimate government, and the resistance is very clear that this is not a legitimate government. There were huge demonstrations on May 1st. This was really the first test for some time, the first test since the inauguration in January, of the power of the resistance. And everybody was nobody knew what was going to happen. And there was somewhere around, I talked to people on the demonstrations that day. They said, 50,000 in San Pedro Sula, maybe 500,000 in the capital, huge numbers in the streets. So people that are interested in Honduras start watching. The next date to pay attention to is June 28th, when there's going to be all kinds of conventions and alternative people's forums going on all over the country as part of this strategy by the resistance to really model the new world in new society in the shell of the old.
So what do you expect the reporting on that to look like here in North America?
This is gonna
this is the whole thing, is we've already gone through the fact that we don't trust our own media. Not that many folks are listening to the alternative media here. I mean, just in terms of our audience is small. I mean, point of fact. So
that's a very interesting question. I think that probably we're going to have some more quote-unquote common violence, and then there will be common violence. And I had an argument with a guy at the State Department last Friday, which was interesting. I've never actually argued with
person. Did you record it?
No, but it was sort of amazing that they actually answered the phone, and I meant to bring the phone number for guys so you could call him.
We could have our own personal argument.
Argument with the State Department. And,
let me recreate that argument real quick.
I can call in next week and give you the phone number, so we can post it on the web somewhere, but you can find them probably. You can call the U.S. Embassy in Honduras, and some of it is I think they're trying to build toward both sides are bad argument again. If you look at the signals coming from Hugo Llorens, the U.S. ambassador to Honduras, he's been making some statements about how Zelaya had acted erratically, quote unquote, before the coup. Again, this is like, well, we needed the coup, even though a coup is, of course, bad. I think that they're going to do everything they can to discredit the resistance. I mean, about a week ago, 2 weeks ago, Llorens made some remarks about really outrageous remarks about how the resistance is just sort of the radical fringe. So I think they're going to try to set it up as a radical fringe. Mm. And judging by my friend at the State Department that I got in the argument with, he also was referring to the resistance as violent, which is really a lie. If you compare it, especially in the context of the massive state terror against members of the resistance, what's going on is the Lobo Sosa government and the paramilitaries that work with it are not killing, for the most part, the top leadership. They're going for rank-and-file people like ourselves, and so everybody can never know who's going to happen next. They did. When I was there, I was on the radio with a guy named Pedro Vizuela, who's a left activist. He's been around forever. He's in his 70s. And 4 days after I got back, they assassinated his daughter. It was clearly a message to him and to anybody that will kill your children. And that's kind of thing that happened in the 80s and happened in other countries in Latin America in the 60s and 70s. And it's terrifying to see that start. There have been escalating death threats. There's been two top leadership figures in the last month. And one is Padre Melo, is also known as Ismael Moreno, and he's the head of director of Radio Progreso, the most important resistance radio station. He's a Jesuit priest in El Progreso on the north coast, somewhere about an hour out of San Pedro Sula. They've been getting death threats ever since the coup. The military tried to shut them down, and it opened up again. And he's been getting escalating death threats. In fact, I know maybe there's somebody out there in the listening community in Santa Cruz. He has called for accompaniment, which means that people that go down there and you spend anywhere from a week to a month following around, living your daily life with him, it would be an incredible opportunity. He's really an amazing figure. And he testified again with he spoke to a number of progressive Congress people about 2 months ago and has been receiving major death threats since. And then in the last week, Carlos Reyes, who was the left candidate for president and is the probably most important public figure on the left in Honduras, head of Stibis, the bottling plant workers union in Tegucigalpa and San Pedro Sula, received a death threat over the phone. And we actually have the phone number. It came in. It's a traceable number. So we're trying to get some kind of prosecution, investigation, and whoever had that death threat against Carlos Reyes. Often you can't trace the phone number. And, this is one of my little conversations with a friend at the State Department. He says, oh, well, we're encouraging COFADE. Now, COFADE is the human rights organization that tracks all this. My friend at the State Department says, we're encouraging COFADE to report this to the proper authorities and have it investigated. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm like, I said, this is so insulting to COFADE, which has been reporting everything to the authorities since the morning of the coup. And then sort of this notion that they need to be told by the paternalistic U.S. State Department to report it to the authorities. And, of course, the authorities are responding to what the U.S. State Department is telling them what to do.
Well, and you, at a certain point under a coup regime, you don't report that to the authorities. It's just simply
what's amazing about
the expectation that the authorities are the ones doing this. The expectation that that you need to report this harassment to the police department.
These people are so brave that they will report things to the authorities, and they do go down there, even though this has been going on since the beginning of the coup. At some point, they started. If I went down there to try to find you, mm-hmm. you're my brother. I know you've disappeared. I know you were grabbed in the middle of demonstration. They would then take pictures of me and write down my name and ask for my identity. It's very dangerous to report things to the police. The most amazing things that people are doing anyway, and they are in the face of the police. And in fact, there's one case, if you want to know how brave a human being can get, there's a young woman, she's 27, and she, during a demonstration in Choloma, which is sort of the bottleneck from where the Maquiladora garment factory and electronic factories products have to go through this one narrow bridge to get to the port, to get to the market. And there have been a lot of demonstrations seizing that, blocking that, about 12 different ones in the course of July, August, and September. And she was at one of the last of those demonstrations in August or September, and she was picked up by the police and separated from the other people she was with and gang raped by four police officers, and told, this is what you get for being part of the resistance, very explicitly. And she went on the radio on Radio Progreso, the same radio station that Padre Melo is the director of, and denounced it and testified about what had happened with her parents there by her side, an incredibly brave thing to do. And about 3 months ago or 2 months ago, I don't know the exact date, she was in a car with members of her family and one woman and two or three men, and they were picked up by police very deliberately. Once again, she and the woman were both gang raped by seven officers or paramilitaries. We don't know who they were. The men were tied to trees and forced to watch them. And they were told, this is what you get for turning us in. And the most amazing thing is that she testified again about what had happened to her. And this kind of sexual violence has been very widespread, and violence against gay lesbian activists, and Walter Choches and several other gay and lesbian activists in the resistance have been killed for these kinds of activities. So it's obviously terrifying situation, and also really amazing how the spirit of the Honduran people in the face of this, it's not like they're just rolling over and play dead. I mean, as a friend of mine emailed to me after, a close friend, and he emailed to me after the daughter of our mutual friend had been killed. She said there's no choice but to keep struggling. We have no other choice. Because, frankly, they don't have any other choice. They will get they will all get killed, most of them, if they don't keep struggling. There's no other way out.
If you can talk about the role of radio in this struggle.
Yeah,
then.
I mean, it's...
It's come up a couple times, but the central role of radio as a medium, as opposed to, you know, television or as opposed to other means of communication, and just what... You mentioned Radio Progresso, and they were streaming online. You could hear the...
Absolutely, you still can.
Yeah.
Radio Progresso HN .com or .org. I can't remember which one it is. It's Radio Progresso, just like it sounds. Mm-hmm. HN, because there's Radio Progressos in other parts of the world. And you can also sometimes get Radio Uno and Radio Globo. Well, the story of the radio in this has really been really breathtaking. And there's a number of different kinds of radio stations. There are two that have a big infrastructure. One is Radio Globo in Tegucigalpa, and it's just privately owned. And the other is Radio Progresso on the North Coast, and they have pretty large transmitters, whatever the word is. In fact, if you go to Radio Progresso, you can see the satellite dish and the big towers, and it's owned by Jesuits, and it comes from the town where Micheletti comes from. So it's very in-your-face, raw class war there going on, and the Jesuits are very important to this. And it has a developed infrastructure, and I've been on Radio Progresso for years, and it's an amazing station even before the resistance, but since the resistance, it's just... Everybody all over the North Coast, and this includes the city of San Pedro Sula, they're listening to it all day, every day, because the newspapers were all lying, and the television stations, all but one in the capital, were all lying. So people knew they were lying, and part of what happened was people had this tremendous awakening of critical thinking about the media. And
ooh, how do we get one of those?
And people say, you know, it was, well,
tremendous awakening,
they call it el cerco mediático, or the media fence. And they say we broke the cerco mediático, or people would, Padre Melo, when I talked to him, was talking about, you know, the curtain was, you know, or the veil is gone from their eyes. And so some of it is that, if you want to know how it happened, is the gap between what the mainstream media was saying and what people could see and were part of was so vast that it really, really discredited it. And then one of the things that the alternative media did was they raised people's consciousness about how the same oligarchic families that ran the coup owned the mainstream, the rest of the media. Mm-hmm. And that cycle, and, you know, some of it, we haven't talked about, there's just some amazing graffiti and signs and slogans that came out of this, and a lot of them had to do with the media. Let me just finish saying about the picture of the media. There's also lots of small radio stations with low range, kind of like you guys, and run by indigenous communities, Afro-indigenous communities, little community stations that sometimes get repressed and shut down, and sometimes death threats, and sometimes people beaten up or killed, and then pop right back up again. And one of those is Radio Uno that I was on when I was there. I was on three different radio stations. And Radio Uno is run by, it's a so-called semi-official journalism school. It's an official, semi-official journalism school in downtown San Pedro Sula. You go in there, and it's run by 15-year-olds in their school uniforms and slicked back hair, and they're running all the technical side of it. It's a very dangerous resistance station, and I was on that station, and people are not only calling in, but commenting on the web from New York and Virginia and all over Honduras. They're watching it on the web. Radio Progresso has all kinds of amazing programs like Sindicalista en el Aire, where the Trade Unionists of the Air, and on Wednesday night had the Women's Trade Unionists of the Air, run by the Banana Unions, have their own radio show, and really also just high-powered world news and some really great music and some music I'm way too old for. So maybe you young people out there can listen to Radio Progresso, a great way to practice your Spanish. And some of when there was a story there I was going to tell something. Oh, the slogans are great. For example, they have one that says, No somos cinco, no somos cien. Prensa vendida, cuéntenos bien. We're not five, we're not 100. Let's see, we're, the number. Yeah, we're not five, we're not 100. Sold out press, count us well. No somos cinco, no somos cien. Prensa vendida, cuéntenos bien. I also saw a picture of a giant banner from a march. I'm sure they use it again. And it had the perfect logo of La Prensa, one of the total coup leader oligarch-owned daily papers. And they had the exact logo, and it says, Read La Prensa. Want to go get stupid in 3 days? Read La Prensa. Like, it was a real ad. So this, like, humor and critical thinking about the media is everywhere. And also just remarking of public life. There's this river that it's just sort of like a giant sewage ditch that you pass between La Lima and Progreso going into San Pedro Sula that we would go over every morning on the way to the Banana Union office where I work when I'm there. And And it's called Rio Tufoso, or the stinky river, or sewage stinky river. So somebody put up a fake, you know, green official sign that says Rio Micheletti, named after the leader of the coup. And there's great stuff like that. A young man, Isi Sobed, who was assassinated by a sniper when Zelaya tried to land his ping at the airport in September. Mm-hmm. The plaza is named Plaza Isi Sobed, and there's things named after Isi Sobed all over the country. So there's this sort of visual and cultural remapping of the country from below. And none of this was going on before, although many of the key elements were in place, like these radio stations. But, you know, people would buy cheap little cell phones so they could listen to Radio Progreso. And you would know, like you walk into a store or a street vendor, you know which side they're on if they're really listening to Radio Progreso. People have little stickers, and if you want to see one, you can see one on my office door in the Humanities Building 1, room 539 at UCSC. I have one that says, Aquí escuchamos Radio Progreso, or Here we listen to Radio Progreso, or a little sticker that says El Libertador, which is a monthly progressive paper put out by left-wing journalists and reporters, and it could have a little discreet sticker in a store window that said, you can hear Aquí se vende El Libertador. Here you can hear the Libertador is sold. And it's a lot of this visual mapping that's going on, and this is all from scratch. It's also really, really tenuous and dangerous because people, for example, now if you call in, there was a story at the end of March by a guy that says if you call into Radio Uno, the one of the semi-official journalism school show, that you get a death threat within 10 minutes. I mean, people call up and threaten you. And, of course, then you think about Romeo Velasquez, the general controlling state-owned telephone company. Like, how do they get somebody's phone number that fast? Mm-hmm. And, and it's a very, very dangerous situation. And it's obviously dangerous for me to go back there after saying these kinds of things on the radio here and there. And imagine how brave people there are to be keeping this up.
Well, in radio, it does have that element of participation. You can write a letter to the editor of the daily paper, but, you know, you can call in. 427-3772.
Go for it.
You can call in, and radio is the people's media because you have a transmitter and a mic, but it's inherently participatory, right?
Well, it doesn't have to be. I mean, you could have a corporate-owned station, and everything's taped, and nobody's...
Yeah, clear channel.
In fact, I just noticed in listening to the car... On the car here, there was a little something about Appleton Communications that turns out to own KBOK, KPIG, the Hippo, and something else. And I'm like, I didn't know that one company owned that many stations that I might listen to in Santa Cruz, other mm-hmm. than all the amazing alternative stations like mm-hmm. KDHC and you guys and KUSP and KZSC. You know, I think that... In Honduras, it's really amazing to see it's much more participatory. I mean, here, I do, you know, I'm on KPFA and other stations pretty regularly, and usually it's a certain kind, usually there's a certain demographic of who's going to call in. It's much broader there. For example, I'll be on Sindicalista, when I was on Sindicalista del Aire, union people that I knew would call in and say hi, and they'll list, they actually list when people have to be at work, at what time, which categories of workers have to be at which time, work at which time on the banana plantation. So a lot of people listen to it to know when and if they're going to be called into work the next day. And so it's very participatory. But also, people call in to talk about something their boss just did. I mean, on the same day, I was on Radio Uno twice and Radio Progreso all in the same day. And in the middle of the day, I went out in a car, in a truck, a pickup truck on a dirt road out to some banana plantations with some people from the banana unions, and it was, of course, my idea of a good time to be on a dirt road listening to singing along with Radio Progreso with some banana union people, and we went out to a banana plantation where they each have about 250 workers, and this is a very highly unionized Chiquita plantation with a very militant union, and there was a lunch meeting, and there were two meetings. We dropped people off at another plantation and went on to ours, and there was a lunch meeting, and people talked about various issues at work and solidarity with the campesinos in the Owan Valley and greetings to me, the visiting gringa, and all this is going on at lunch, and then we picked up the people that we dropped off at the other plantation, the union people, and we said, how did it go? And they said, well, it went really great, but they only gave us, we're supposed to have an hour for it. In the union contract, we have an hour for this once a month or so meeting, and they only gave us a half an hour. They wouldn't give us more than that or something like that. I don't remember the exact time thing. And so, like, we're on Radio Progreso, like, 4 hours later, and people are denouncing it on the radio that the company didn't give them their time. And the other people on the show, or they have the women's show on Wednesday night, and it's like a young woman who'd been on three or four times, a former Maquiladora worker who's now an organizer, and a woman who was like maybe 32, who was her first time reading her little script on the radio, Padre Melo and the engineer there in the booth, and the woman who's the engineer. And it's like this, and then Edie Smugia, who's head of the women's projects in the Banana Unions, and a guy officer from the union who'd driven someone up there. They're all sitting on the floor in the studio, and I'm on there telling them about, you know, the work we're doing in the United States. And it was this incredible sense of community empowerment. And, of course, why is it that they're getting bomb threats and death threats against Padre Melo? Because Radio Progreso is this massively important community institution. And if they can, you know, you can imagine how much they hate it. Now, then the question is, what's going to happen leading up to, you know, what happens next in all this? And is Radio Progreso going to be targeted as some kind of terrorist operation run by Hugo Chavez? You know, that's what you could sort of imagine what might happen here.
And so as the anniversary approaches, you get the sense that there's going to be some mobilizations, there's going to be some press, there's going to be people commemorating the one-year anniversary
of the
coup. Yeah, and
again, it's June 28th. It's coming up. I mean, they're planning a giant assembly and a constitutional conversations about what a new constitution would look like. Mm-hmm. And this is this part of this go for broke. I mean, we're long past Restore Zelaya. They're like, why is it that we have had this actually terrible constitution written by a military government under the Reagan administration in 1982? I think the big thing here we haven't talked about enough is the Obama administration. And I think a lot of us had hopes that Obama might be okay. And in fact, Obama has been worse than Bush in Latin America. And I think that most on the left would agree with that. And my metaphor, and it's interesting that this metaphor works in Honduras because we have so much cultural imperialism that they know about the Lord of the Rings. But it's a Lord of the Rings metaphor, which was Sauron's eye was on the Middle East. You know, mm-hmm. The empire was concentrated in the Middle East under the George W. Bush administration. And Obama's smarter than that and realized they, quote unquote, were losing Latin America. And they, all these democratic left and center left governments had come to power in Latin America. And the U.S. doesn't find that acceptable to its corporate imperial agenda in Latin America. And, you know, this is where how you get coup light. You know, it's like, oh, both sides are to blame. Oh, yes, we feel terrible. It's a coup, but we're going to cut part of the money. And oh, we wish they could all just get along down there. And now we've got this line about, oh, this is a government of reconciliation. And, you know, and oh, they have a lot of common crime down there. And everything's really okay. And why is the OAS acting, why is the Organization of American States and being so difficult when we just want to be friendly? And
yeah, we want democracy.
Yeah, we want democracy. And they're going to be keep talking about, now it's a complicated dance because they also have to repress the resistance. And so there's this ante and, you know, tensions that are growing. And the question is, can the resistance survive and grow in the face of this state terror and death squad activity? You know, three more people were killed in the last week, and the journalists are terrified, you know, picking off journalists. You know, and the other piece of this is, where is the mass movement in the United States? And, you know, there is now a small national network of about 25 groups. You know, it's very, very small. And those of us, part of it is how many people knew about Honduras before this happened. You know, I went from zero to Honduras expert in about 2 hours, you know, simply because I'd been working with the labor movement and researching Honduras for about 10 years. But this is this problem is the U.S. is counting on the fact that there's a lot of people think, well, I don't know anything about Honduras, so I don't know what to say. And, you know, you can certainly say that an ongoing military government is bad. And why is the U.S. backing it? You can let's talk a little bit about what people can do. Can I say that? You can certainly denounce the bogus Lobo government. You can say it is an ongoing coup regime and an illegitimate government. You can should say stop military aid to Honduras. You should say, don't recognize this really bogus truth commission, and have stop having U.S. recognition of the government and military and humanitarian aid. And the left does, the Frente has asked for a cut for all aid, not just the military aid. So if you're wondering about what people are asking for, you can write a letter to the editor, to the Sentinel, to you name it paper. That's all you need to know. You don't have to know a whole lot more than that, is that we have this ongoing, why is the Obama government still supporting a military coup in Honduras? And why isn't the paper talking about that? Why aren't there stories about the death squad activity that's ongoing in Honduras, and why is it being reported as common crime? Write to the Chronicle, write to the Sentinel, say, why aren't they covering it? Why are they covering it with such a bias? You don't have to be an expert to be able to say that. Sam Farr, a congressman, has actually been one of the very best people in the country. You can call him up and thank him and keep the pressure on that he should keep acting to it. If you're in Anna Eshoo's district or somebody else's district, I don't think you can hear me, but, you know, if you're getting this on the web or some other way, you know, put pressure on her. You can call my friends at the State Department. You can call the U.S. Embassy in Honduras. And certainly you can call the State, the White House. You call the State Department. You can call Ms. Clinton. And just say, you know, please stop all military aid to Honduras. The fact that they even think you're paying attention will matter. And also try to get, if you're the most, I think in terms of the middle range, is if you're in a labor movement, a union, or if you're in a faith-based community, please try to get them involved. Bring somebody from Honduras. I can help you on this. And please try to get people in whatever association you're part of to get involved in building a mass knowledge about Honduras.
And how do we get out the information coming from the Alternative Truth Commission with Rigoberta Menchú, and how do we support the people who are down there actually doing the resistance?
One thing you can do, I think what they want you to do is put the pressure on our government here.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what they want you to do. They want you to put pressure on Congress and on the White House and on the State Department. So, you know, there's things you can do to support them down there. They're pretty amazing on the ground there. They need us to be doing our work up here, and they need to know that we're doing it. I can tell you some websites that are useful, and the best one in English is actually called quotha.net, Q-U-O-T-H-A, Q-U-O-T-H-A.net. It's run by a woman named Adrienne Pine, who's a professor at American University, an anthropologist, and she has this amazing website, and she reprints and translates stuff coming from the resistance. If you Google Frente Nacional de la Resistencia Popular, or FNRP, and Google Honduras, you can get the direct missives and communiques coming from the resistance. You can listen to Radio Progreso and go to their website, radioprogressohn.org. It might be .com, but I think it's .org. If you want the really great stuff coming straight from Honduras, there's a wonderful website called voselsoberano.com, and it's V-O-S, and vos, that's sort of like two in Central American, in Spanish, vos, el, E-L, soberano, S-O-B as in boy, E-R-A-N-O, voselsoberano.com. And they have amazing, and if that's the real up-to-the-minute postings, I think those are the best three places that I would go to. But you can also just try Googling Honduran resistance. You'll pick up all kinds of stuff in Spanish and in English.
Well, and one of the most telling things I've seen in terms of available media here is Lanny David, to his teeny little bit of credit, actually appeared on Democracy Now! in as part of a debate that was really telling. He was really honest.
He was lying all over the place. He was so honest, but, you know, that debate is playing with poor Greg Grandin, because he was so dumbfounded because Lanny Jesus just came up there and lied and lied and lied. And I think we were all so new to how to even be able to handle this, and stunned at how completely, I don't remember exactly how Lanny Davis was lying.
Me neither, but just being able to hear someone so openly defending with broad generalizations and just such an apologist and a paid apologist was incredible to hear.
And who was Hillary Clinton's lobbyist in the campaign
Precisely.
Against Obama.
Yeah.
So you want to see how interlocked, you know, in the old days we used to talk about interlocked directorates, you can just see how interlocked this cast of character is.
Indeed. We have a caller who wanted to jump on and ask a question, actually, which I thought was going to come right on through there, but it didn't. So we might get that call back. But I did want to, again, encourage folks to check out that information and ask you if you have any final thoughts, because unfortunately we're out of time.
Well, I just want people to get involved and care about Honduras and keep talking about it and, you know, keep putting pressures on the newspaper and keep being informed. There's a very excellent article by Jeremy Kryt, K-R-Y-T, in the East Times that just came out, and it's on the cover. It says... Return of the Death Squads. I have an article in The Nation that was the April 5th issue of The Nation. You can get that online, and another one in NACLA. The January-February issue of NACLA has really great background articles by Adrienne Pine, Rosemary Joyce, and Suyapa Portillo. And you can, all of those articles are really excellent if you're trying to get some more background here.
And you also mentioned that organization, fledgling, if I could say that, but a smaller national network of organizations.
Yes, so it's just an online list, the Presente Honduras list, that is doing networking. We don't have a Santa Cruz affiliate except myself. And, there are some people that are like Phil McManus locally that have paid attention to it. But there are people in the Bay Area that have brought speakers down, for example.
Wonderful. Matt or Embry, are you there this time?
Yeah, I am.
Wonderful.
Yeah, hey, sorry, I got cut off there.
No, not a problem.
I just wanted to add something real quick. I've really been enjoying the show, and part of it for me is a way to go forward beyond writing letters and calling, and I think that's really helpful. I'm not saying we shouldn't do that, but as well just getting to where we don't have hope for the next Democratic, whoever the Higgle is presented up there, where we completely reject the sort of one party that we have and really, get busy with supporting, third parties, other independent constructs. I think that presents more of a way forward to the type of resistance movement that you're seeing in Honduras, to kind of have that here. And I think also, like Obama, he was giving a lot of direct signs that he was going to be really, repressive and stupid in foreign policy, just during the campaign. And a lot of his justifications are just really silly and would be easily torn apart by like Noam Chomsky or anybody who they'd put up there with him. It's only because he's protected and able to just give these really staged speeches about everything that people are even swallowing his bullshit, really. And honestly, like seeing where they stand on issues like this, it makes me totally question other things he does, even that are minimally positive in a domestic realm. I think we need to firmly reject those, because the basic, his basic motivations are shown to be, diseased and faulty, not good. Definitely supporting repressive forces. And I think it's sad that if people saw, I think they got a lot of excited by the social progress of it and these other things having to do with, racial inequality. And that's fine and all, but it is. We see it as kind of a tokenism that really doesn't have much meaning, especially in context of the repression that you've been talking about through this whole show.
I think so much. Many people had to go through a learning process about who Obama was or wasn't. I mean, some of us thought, gee, maybe he's slightly liberal, but there was certainly, like you say, signals before he was elected. He was on Univision in an interview saying, I saw him like right before the election, a few days before, saying we have to stop Hugo Chavez from exporting terrorism. Well, excuse me, since when is Hugo Chavez exporting terrorism? And what are you doing saying that on television before the election? And that was a signal to the Cuban right in Miami, and to all the elites that are in Miami about which side he was going to be on. But, I think so many of us, wanted to think that maybe some part of him was going to be more progressive, and we know that now. I think it's very hard to people accept that quite how right-wing he has been in Latin America. Revival of the Sixth Fleet, this isn't just about Honduras. This is also about new bases in Colombia, new aid to Colombia, new bases in Panama. Now we have a new base in Honduras, and a most spectacularly support for the coup in Honduras. And I think that people need to really, it's over now. We're not giving him the benefit. There's the time when the jury is out. People were saying that the first 2 months of the coup, and I'm like, excuse me, if you heard Hillary Clinton say that first day, both sides are responsible for this situation, and Obama, refusing to call it a military coup and cut off on military aid, that went on and on and on. They knew exactly what they were doing. There was a lot of debates about what was really going on inside the State Department, and I'm like, it was pretty clear to me exactly what they were doing.
Okay, all right, I know, here, and there's been a host of issues, like the way the administration has treated Iran, to me is basically racist, because it's never mentioned that Israel is not going by the non-proliferation treaty, or Pakistan and India, but somehow Iran is uniquely unqualified to have nuclear weapons. It's just ridiculous, that, and just the increase in predator bombings in Pakistan is a very significant, ominous, completely wrong policy. There's just a lot, and I certainly, I didn't want to be overly negative, of course, and we all want to believe that even minimal positive domestic things can be done, just on a short-term level. But anyway, I want to let you go on, because I know you're trying to wrap up the show, but just thanks so much. You're like an encyclopedia on the situation. It's really
thank you,
amazing.
But you don't know what else I didn't do in my life for the last year. It's been pretty exhausting, please can I be off the beat for a few days?
Sure. Thanks
a lot.
I understand.
Thanks so much.
You're so articulate and knowledgeable about it, though. I really appreciate
it. Thanks very much.
Thanks for the show.
Thanks for listening, and thanks for calling in. And I really appreciate hearing that voice as well of you know, write your senators, write your congressmen. And another alternative is to organize with that example in mind. To talk about you know, our own lack of media democracy, our own lack of actual representative democracy, our own
movimiento amplio, or the broad movement. I mean, we really need to use this example of how we all say enough already. We really have to have an alternative understanding of the whole society and really unite for social justice. And we, of course, dream of that. But we thought it was Honduras that was going to put it all together.
And there's so many things that you said that are just. There's just such easy parallels to draw. So yeah, it's really good for us to be remembering.
Well, and also don't underestimate the role of what you're doing here, because I don't think anybody thought how important alternative radio would become in Honduras. Now imagine if you had a corrupt Congress, a corrupt Supreme Court, and a corrupt
imagine.
Imagine if they took over military the country and suddenly shut down every and these little radio stations are the only way you could find out. I mean, which doesn't mean we don't have our own media fans, but people are saying, oh, well, kind of, it's not really a coup and all that. They don't really understand what it would actually mean if the generals were running the airports. And, of course, they are running the airports in the middle.
George Herbert Walker Airport.
And as the caller, the racial politics of all this is, watch out for it. This is going to play into sort of the little brown people down there in Latin America can't govern themselves when we're the one governing them at the point of a gun.
Well, thank you very much for your
time and for your work and caring about Honduras.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, and I want you to stay tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Are we off?
La historia de nuestra lengua, vida, arte y obra de un pueblo que tregua.